Yesterday I offered you a list of groups as a motivation for studying certain problems in geometry, and in particular this question of looking at open orbits was opened, for me it sort of opens a window on new types of geometry. And at the end of yesterday's lecture I talked about how the spin representations of spin n, n could be incorporated into ordinary geometry by considering the tangent bundle plus the cotangent bundle with this structure. So what I want to do today is to talk about a very concrete problem which starts out in a very normal way. So I want to just look at ordinary four-dimensional Riemannian manifolds and certain problems defined on those. But then I want to set it in this wider context of what are called generalized complex structures, and see how these results actually make certain suggestions about moduli spaces, in fact moduli spaces of instantons. So let me begin by talking about bihermitian four-manifolds. So we're going to do a bit of Riemannian geometry here in four dimensions. I'm sure a lot of it will be familiar to a number of you in the audience. So we have a Riemannian four-manifold, and we look at the curvature tensor. The conformal invariant part of that is called the Weyl tensor. It splits into two halves, the self-dual and the anti-self-dual Weyl tensor. And when you're studying four-dimensional Riemannian geometry, it's often very convenient to use spinor notation. So in particular, the V plus is the one of the spin bundles, and in four dimensions we can take the projectivized bundle. That's a bundle of complex projective lines. Another way of looking at it is as the unit sphere bundle inside the bundle of self-dual two forms. So again, we have two forms. We have self-dual and anti-self-dual two forms. The bundle of self-dual two forms is a rank three bundle in a product. Look at the unit sphere in there. That also has an interpretation as a projectivized spinor bundle. And then, but the spinor bundle interpretation is very useful, because then this Weyl tensor in Penrose's notation can be thought of as a four-component spinor. And what that really means is that it's a section of the bundle which is the fourth symmetric power of this spin bundle. So if we think of that in terms of the projectivized spinor bundle, then this is basically a quartic polynomial on the at each point on the underlying complex two-dimensional vector space. So it gives us four points, four distinguished points in general in the fiber of this projective bundle over each point. So these points have certain interpretation. So for example, if we have now an almost complex structure on the manifold which is compatible with the metric, then that defines a two-form, a Kähler form if you like, or a Hermitian two-form, which is automatically self-dual. And if that almost complex structure is integrable, then in fact one can show that the plus or minus omega sitting inside the two-dimensional sphere, so these antipodal points in the two-dimensional sphere, these are really two of these rather special points. In other words, the integrability links up that two-form with the Weyl tensor. So, I mean, it's not true the other way around. I mean, we always have these two pairs here, but it's not always true that the almost complex structure they define is integrable. So if we go the other way, if the structure is integrable, then actually these are roots of the quartic. Well, but there are four roots in general. So you can ask, well, what happens if you have two integrable Hermitian structures? Then you've used up all four of these roots. So it's a very natural idea to think of manifolds, Riemannian manifolds in four dimensions with two integrable complex structures. As such, they are defined, in fact, those complex structures are defined by the metric because they are these distinguished points determined by the Weyl tensor. Now, obviously, if you have more than two, then the Weyl tensor is going to vanish, and that leads you into another part of mathematics, twister theory, essentially, that when W plus vanishes, then this projectivized spin bundle is that it has an integrable complex structure. It is itself a complex manifold of dimension 3. And then there are infinitely many integrable complex structures compatible with the metric. All you have to do is to take a local, at least locally, all you have to do is to take a hypersurface, a complex surface inside this complex three-dimensional manifold, which is transverse to these fibers of the projectivized spin bundle, and that will define you a complex structure on the underlying manifold compatible with the metric. So the condition that there are two integrable complex structures is somehow halfway between the general situation and the self-dual situation. So these are called the bi-Hermitian structures, and until relatively recently, at least in the mathematics community, there weren't many examples known of these. I think Kobach was the first to produce an explicit local example. These authors gave a rather exhaustive treatment of structures on compact, complex surfaces. So they used the classification of surfaces to give a list of candidates for compact surfaces which might admit such a bi-Hermitian structure. Now, I should say that in fact, although Riemannian geometers got interested in these perhaps in the late 90s, physicists already knew about them way back in 1984, and I have to admit that in 84, I spent a year in Stony Brook talking to Martin Rocek, and he kept telling me about these things, and I took no notice. In the end, we wrote a paper about hyperkähler manifolds, which I understood much better. But there's a lesson here. I should have listened to a physicist 20 years ago, and maybe I would have learned more about these bi-Hermitian structures then. Anyway, this time they have been studied by differential geometers with some interesting results. So one of the results of Godeschon and the others, Apostolov, is the following, that and it really is what leads to their classification. So if you take, so you have your Riemannian metric, you have your two most complex structures. Suppose you look at the commutator of these. So we don't impose any particular algebraic relationship between I plus and I minus. Then this expression here is skew symmetric. It's a skew symmetric form, so it's a two form. And in fact, it lies in the 2, 0 plus 0, 2 part of. So if we think of I plus, and we think of decomposing forms in type, in 1, 1, 2, 0, and 0, 2, then this lies inside this real two-dimensional subspace, which lies inside the self-dual two forms. And that's true by symmetry, if you like, for both complex structures. So suppose you choose one complex structure, I plus, say, then you can turn this into a 0, 2 form, let's call it sigma, and then using the metric, you can identify that with a section of the second exterior power of the complex tangent bundle. So what they prove is that actually, in most of the situations they're interested in, that this bivector, this complex bivector, if you like, is actually holomorphic. And what that means is that M, the underlying complex manifold, can be thought of as a Poisson manifold. A holomorphic Poisson manifold. We have a complex bivector. We're only in two dimensions, so the integrability condition of the Poisson structure is automatic. But the important thing is to say that their analysis of this led them to look at complex manifolds which have holomorphic sections of this line bundle, the second exterior power of the tangent bundle, the anti-canonical bundle. So then they could appeal to Kodaira's classification of surfaces and look at the ones which have anti-canonical divisors and so on, and arrange all these candidates. What wasn't so clear is whether, it still is not clear, which one of these actually admit such bi-Hermitian metrics. So now let me make a link now with generalized complex structures. So this is going back then to yesterday, to the idea of structures related to the group UM, M or SON, N. So let me remind you about, first of all, let me point out that this whole idea of a generalized complex structure began when I was following up the spin 6-6 situation of the open orbit. I wrote a paper on these on properties of what I call generalized Calabi-Yau manifolds in six dimensions. But then my former student, Marco Gualtieri, who's here at the Fields Institute, he wrote his thesis on the complex geometry, or rather than the Calabi-Yau geometry, of these objects. So he proved a number of results which are very relevant to what I'm going to say today. So the situation is that we think of the bundle T plus T star instead of just the tangent bundle on its own. So we think of X as a vector field, psi in one form, and then X plus psi we think of as a section of T plus T star. And then instead of the Lie bracket on the tangent bundle, on sections of the tangent bundle, we have this other bracket called the Courant bracket, which is slightly mysterious, but is clearly the right object to make everything work. So it looks like when we take the Courant bracket of this, then on the vector field part, we just take the ordinary Lie bracket, and then this term here is really just the natural action of the algebra of vector fields on one forms, and then we have this extra peculiar term, which is somehow what drives the Courant bracket. So if we didn't have this, this would simply be the Lie bracket on the group whose the algebra is vector fields with a semi-direct product with one form. But with the extra term, we don't get a Lie bracket. It doesn't satisfy the Jacobi identity. But anyway, it has other special properties. So this is called the Courant bracket. Courant bracket. Now, what is a generalized complex structure? We just imitate the definition of a complex structure, or a Kähler structure, strictly speaking, but using T plus T star with its indefinite metric given by pairing tangent vectors and cotangent vectors, and replacing the Lie bracket by the Courant bracket. So what we say is that it's a decomposition of the complexification into a complex vector bundle plus its conjugate, in such a way that E is isotropic with respect to the natural pairing. So if we restrict the complexification of the metric on this to E or E bar, it's totally zero. And the integrability condition is that the sections of E should be closed under the Courant bracket. And so what that means is that effectively, if we look at the real vector bundle T plus T star, then we have a complex structure J on that, together with this, which is compatible with the metric, together with this integrability condition. So that's a natural definition. It's one which imitates the way that we look at ordinary complex manifolds. The interesting feature about it is that it's a definition which encompasses two extremes. One is an ordinary complex manifold. So J looks like this. The sub-bundle of the complexified tangent bundle plus cotangent bundle looks like this. But at the other extreme, a symplectic manifold is also an example of a generalized complex manifold. In that case, J has this off-diagonal term, and this is the span. This is the E is defined by this collection of vector fields plus one form. So this is, in fact, one of my motivations for trying to look at this underlying geometry, that it encompasses both complex geometry and symplectic geometry. And my hope was it might have something to do with mirror symmetry, which interchanges those two objects. One of the most important results in Marco's thesis is that there is a Kuranishi deformation, a local moduli space of such things, which is determined by a complex, and the two extremes, in the symplectic case, the complex is just the ordinary Durand complex, and for a complex manifold, it's the Dolbo complex with values in the polyvector field, the pth exterior power of the holomorphic tangent bundle. And so in particular, the infinitesimal deformation space, like the tangent space of this moduli space, if it's a smooth moduli space, actually, so if we start with a complex manifold and think of deforming it as a generalized complex manifold, then the infinitesimal tangent space is this. So this is these Dolbeau cohomology groups. This corresponds to just deformations of the complex structure. This is, well, deformations of what's called the B field, but more interestingly, the holomorphic sections of the second exterior power of the tangent bundle appear here as deformations. And what it means is that actually a complex Poisson manifold is another example of a generalized complex manifold. So if you like, what we have is that from the work of the differential geometers, we ended up by looking, if we're looking for bi-Hermitian metrics, then we're looking for complex Poisson manifolds. On the other hand, complex Poisson manifolds are examples of these generalized complex structures. So what I want to try and show you is the way that certain problems related to four-dimensional Riemannian geometry have a new flavor when we restrict to these types of manifolds. So if you're interested in Poisson manifolds over complex numbers, standard examples are, say, complex projective plane, say, and then the anti-canonical bundle is O3, so sections of that are given by cubic forms on the underlying vector space. So a holomorphic Poisson structure consists of a section of this which will vanish on a cubic. But in higher dimensions, you can take the Hilbert scheme of points on a Poisson surface, the desingularized symmetric product, or you, that again is Poisson, or you could take the moduli space of stable bundles on a Poisson surface, that again is a Poisson manifold. This has been known for some years now. The idea is the following, that if you look at the tangent space to the moduli space of stable bundles, then it's given by H1 of the endomorphism bundles, endomorphism sheaf of the bundle. The cotangent space at the bundle is given by its dual, which by Sayre duality is this. So if we have two cotangent vectors, then we take the product, or the trace of the product, that lies in H2 with values in the square of the canonical bundle, but then we multiply by sigma, which is a section of the dual of the canonical bundle, and that gives us the canonical bundle itself, and this cohomology class is complex numbers. So this is a skew symmetric pairing. It gives us a skew form on the cotangent bundle, and then one has to prove that it's actually satisfies the identity, the differential identity, to make it into a Poisson manifold. So I think this was maybe first done by Bottacin, but a number of others, Markman and others, were involved in that. So there are examples of Poisson manifolds in higher dimensions. Okay, so what I just talked about was a generalized complex manifold. Now there's a more important notion now is that of a generalized Kähler manifold. So here we recall that, well, from what I just said, that two cases of a generalized complex manifold were a symplectic manifold and a complex manifold. And we know that when you have a symplectic structure and a complex structure which are suitably compatible, then we get a Kähler manifold. So the idea here is to say, well, okay, a complex structure defines you one almost complex structure on T plus T star, a symplectic structure defines another. Suppose we ask what are the compatibility conditions for J1 and J2 in order that that we get a Kähler metric, and the answer is that the two should commute. And then you can say, well, let's look in sort of more generality, let's adopt this as a definition, and say that a generalized Kähler manifold consists of two generalized complex structures, J1 and J2, which commute, and also we need a non-degeneracy condition such that that this inner product is actually positive definite. So that's what we define as a generalized Kähler manifold. So it uses the fact that symplectic structures and complex structures are the same type of object here within generalized complex geometry, and the compatibility condition is very, very simple to make. So what are these? Well, another of Marco's theorems from his thesis says the following, that it actually links up directly with the sort of structure that Rochek, Gates and Hull were looking at 20-odd years ago. Namely, a generalized Taylor manifold actually is equivalent to a number of things. One is, first of all, you have a metric, just an ordinary Riemannian metric on your manifold. You have two integrable complex structures which are compatible with the metric. You have a two-form, B, and you have a relationship. So these are not Taylor metrics, but what you have is the relationship that the DC operator, so this is the real operator obtained by conjugating D with complex structure I, so this is the relationship DC minus omega minus is DB, which is minus DC plus omega plus. So in particular, because this is closed, you get DDC of omega is equal to zero. And an equivalent way of saying that is that there are actually two connections with holonomy UN corresponding to I plus and I minus, so two connections, nabla plus, nabla minus, compatible with the metric, compatible nabla plus with the complex structure I plus, nabla minus with I minus, but these are not the Levi-Civita connections, they have torsion, and that torsion is a three-form, it's skew-symmetric, and that three-form is the exterior derivative of B. If you want the Levi-Civita connection, then you take the average of these two connections. So, somewhat remarkably, this structure is what physicists 20 years ago were interested in, and it drops out of this generalized complex structure point of view. So, what can you do with it? Well, one thing you can do is to actually use the generalized point of view to give some constructions for bi-Hermitian metrics. So, the first one, the easiest way to start is to look at the general case. So, if I look at a generalized complex structure, then it's determined in the generic case by two things. One is a symplectic form, omega, and the other is a closed two-form, B. So you put them together into a complex two-form, and then you define the sub-bundle of the complexified T plus T star as a set of X plus Xi such that interior product with X plus exterior product with Xi on the exponential of beta is equal to zero. So this defines you a generalized complex structure. So all we need then is a symplectic structure and this B field, this closed two form. And that's in a way the generic situation. So, and if you now want to consider generalized Kähler in the generic case, or in this is a generic even case, this is where both complex structures are of this type, then you can rewrite that in terms of an algebraic identity on the two complex two forms. So the commutation of the two almost complex structures is equivalent to a dimensionality constraint on the intersections of these E1s and E2 bars. And that can be achieved by these algebraic identities. So we're now on a 4K, real 4K dimensional manifold, and what you want is that this 2K plus 2 form should be zero, and this 2K plus 2 form. So these are nonlinear constraints on beta 1 and beta 2, but once you've got those, then you have a generalized Kähler manifold. So one way is to take a hyper-Kähler manifold, and to say that so omega 1, omega 2, and omega 3, these are the three covariant constant two forms, and then to take as a symplectic form omega, in one case this, omega 2 minus omega 3, and the other one omega 2 plus omega 3, and then the B field here is omega 1. Then it's easy to check that, so these are closed forms, and it's easy to check that these satisfy those identities. So a hyper-Kähler manifold is automatically a generalized Kähler manifold. On the other hand, Dominic Joyce pointed out that you could actually deform this just by taking a function. So if you take any function now on your manifold, it generates a Hamiltonian vector field by using omega 1 as the symplectic form. And then if you deform these by pulling, so you integrate the Hamiltonian vector field to a one-parameter group of diffeomorphisms, if you pull omega 3 around with this, then you get the same relationships, the same algebraic relationships, but different two forms. So these generalized Kähler metrics are relatively free. As we know, that a Kähler metric on a manifold, we can always add dd bar of a small function to a Kähler metric and get another one. In a similar way, this is a lot of freedom. We could just change this function by adding on any other small function and we'd still get the same structure. So that's one way of looking at examples. Another way is if you want something concrete. So I'm particularly interested in the case of CP2 with this, where we take J1 to be the Poisson structure given by this. So this is if you like a meromorphic two form on CP2, which has a pole, a triple pole along the line at infinity. So the cubic curve in what I talked about earlier is really a triple line here. And then you can say, well, let's take that to be one of the complex structures, and let's try to match it with a generalized complex structure of general type like this, and let's throw in SU2 invariants to see what we get. So this is a typical way in which you might look for the simplest possible solutions, throw in as much symmetry as you can. And, well, what it turns out is that if you write things in terms of invariant forms, then beta 1 is this standard object. Beta 2, here is the general form for it. So Hij is now a matrix depending on one parameter, the radius, if you like. Lambda and mu are functions, complex functions, depending on the same parameter. You plug in these relations, it gives you these algebraic relations between lambda and mu. And then you look at the equations, and it turns out that you can solve these equations just by quadratures. So, if you like, locally, you can solve these equations using just one free function, lambda, one complex free function of one variable. If you want to fit this on CP2, you have to impose some conditions. The function lambda should behave like r squared at 0 and 1 over r squared at infinity. But you have enough freedom to determine only a bi-Hermitian metric this way. So it's slightly amusing to note that this general ansatz gives you a solution which depends on one complex function of one variable. If you were just looking at an ordinary Kähler manifold, then you could write it, of course, as locally as dd bar log of a function, a real-valued function. If you throw in the SU2 symmetry, that will be a real-valued function of one variable. So there's a sense in which generalized Kähler has twice as much freedom as an ordinary Kähler manifold. But the equations are rather different. Okay, so we can actually find examples on simple objects like CP2, examples of these bi-Hermitian metrics. And also on something like a K3 surface, because we can take the hyper-Kähler metric and we can deform it in the way that Joyce did. So now what I want to do is to look at instantons on four manifolds endowed with a bi-Hermitian metric. And to try and ask the question, what sort of structure is inherited by the instanton moduli space if we have a bi-Hermitian structure on the four manifold? It's a natural question. So let me recall now situation with the Young-Mills equations. So again, we have the two forms on a four manifold decomposed into self-dual and anti-self-dual ones. And a connection satisfies the anti-self-duality equations if its curvature is an anti-self-dual two-form with values in the Lie algebra. So now if you have a Hermitian structure, then we know that the anti-self-dual two-forms are actually all of type 1-1. They are, in fact, they're 1-1 and orthogonal to the Kähler form, if you like. Or another way of saying it is that they're primitive and of type 1-1. So in particular, what we see is that if we're on a bi-Hermitian four-manifold, then if we have an instanton, a solution to the anti-self-dual Young-Mills equations, then its curvature is of type 1-1 with respect to both complex structures, because both complex structures are compatible with the same metric, and therefore its curvature well, is it type 1-1? And that means, there's a well-known theorem which says that actually that means that the that the connection defines a complex structure on the underlying vector bundle. So what we can say is that an antiself, that an instanton on a bi-Hermitian manifold is actually a holomorphic bundle in two different ways, one with respect to I plus and one with respect to I minus. Now you might ask about stability. So what we know is that that there are relations between moduli spaces of stable bundles and moduli spaces of instantons. That there's a correspondence that if you have a stable bundle, then there exist existence theorems, which say that a stable bundle on a Kähler manifold, for example, if a bundle is stable, then there's a unique instanton connection on that bundle compatible with the holomorphic structure. Now, stability is usually described using for projective varieties or Kähler varieties, but it turns out that there is a version of stability which makes sense in the Hermitian context. So here, of course, I mean, my basic example is CP2 that I'm thinking of, which is a Kähler manifold, but I'm not thinking of it as a Kähler manifold. I'm thinking of it as a bi-Hermitian manifold. So we have to discuss stability. So what the important point here is to note that these relations imply that DDC of omega is equal to zero. Now, what we can do is that we can imitate the notion of a degree of a line bundle that would work on a Kähler manifold. That would say you would take, well, strictly speaking, you would take the first Chern class of the line bundle, take the cut product with the Kähler form. So that's represented, well, modulo 2 pi, by the curvature of the line bundle wedged with the Kähler form. So in Kähler geometry, that will be what you would call the degree of the line bundle, and if the Kähler form is integral, this is an integer. Well, the same definition works in the situation that we've got. I mean, you can make the definition, but then you have to ask the question, does that depend on the connection on the line bundle? And, well, it turns out that in this situation, it doesn't depend on that connection because we've got a holomorphic line bundle, we choose a metric on it, we get a canonical connection. If we choose a different metric, then the curvature of the connection varies by adding on DDC log of something. So when we integrate against omega, the extra term will be this, but integrating by parts, you pass it over to the other side, and then because DDC omega is zero, that's equal to zero. So stability is actually well defined. It's not an integer, this degree, but it's a real number, and you can, using the notion of degree of subbundles, you can define stability for a complex holomorphic bundle on a bi-Hermitian manifold. Well, actually, on a Hermitian manifold, which satisfies this condition. In fact, in this situation, we have theorems which work in the same way as the original Uhlenbeck-Yau theorem, namely that if you have a stable holomorphic bundle on a Hermitian manifold defined in this way, then actually there does exist a unique anti-self dual Yang-Mills connection compatible with the holomorphic structure. So this was, I think, Li and Yao were the first ones to prove this. And then Buchdahl looked at the complex surface case. And there's a good account of the whole general picture in this book by Lubke and Telemann. So Telemann wrote his thesis on this whole area, and there are a number of aspects which go beyond the actual existence theorem. So we have a pretty good hold on the relationship between stable bundles and instantons for these bi-Hermitian manifolds. So what we want to do is to look at the moduli space. So that, in other words, the space of all anti-self dual connections modulo gauge equivalence. And what we see is that if we apply the Li-Yau theorem, then we can reinterpret that moduli space in two different ways, one as the moduli space of stable bundles for the complex structure I plus, and the other as the moduli space for I minus. So we already see that this moduli space has two different integrable complex structures. The question is, what other properties does it have? What happens to the metric? So this is the aim. The aim is to show that this moduli space of instantons is again a generalized Kähler manifold. In other words, it has these two complex structures. It's going to have these two connections, nabla plus, nabla minus, which satisfy these equations which were written down 20 years ago by Rochek and the others. So what we have to do is to understand how do you introduce a metric on the moduli space of instantons. Well, there's a standard way of doing this. So the picture is the following. So think of the screen as being the space of all solutions to the anti-self-dual Young-Mills equations, and G here as being the infinite dimensional group of gauge transformations. So what we're looking for are the quotient space of this infinite dimensional space modulo this gauge action. So it's the space of orbits under the action of G. This already by integration, this already has a metric. The tangent space to the space of connections is a one form A with values in the Lie algebra. We use the inner product from the Killing form and the metric on the manifold to define an L2 inner product on such one forms. And then, normally speaking, what you do is you take the orthogonal complement of the gauge orbits, then this is G invariant, restrict the metric to this, and that will define your metric on the moduli space. And then, by integration by parts, you find that this orthogonal complement consists of the one forms which satisfy this adjoint equation. So this is a covariant D star. It involves the connection that you're at. Well, that's the standard way to get a metric on the moduli space. The trouble is it doesn't actually work in this Hermitian situation. In the Kähler situation, fine, that's what you do. In the non-Kähler situation, it's not the right thing to do. And that was pointed out by Telemann and Lubke, that this is what you have to do, that you choose a different slice. So instead of choosing the orthogonal complement to the tangent space to the G orbit, you look at this equation. So here's dCa wedged with omega. So this is a four form, top degree form. So it's very similar to this equation. In fact, if you were on a Kähler manifold, it will be exactly the same as this equation. But we're not on a Kähler manifold, so it's rather different. So what Telemann shows is that actually if you use this slice, then so you look at the induced inner product on that slice and define a metric on the quotient space using that, then that is Hermitian. So in other words, the natural complex structure given by the moduli space of stable bundle structure on that moduli space is actually Hermitian with respect to this metric. And not only that, but he shows that the G connection, so you see, at this point, what we're doing is we've got some space with G orbits, so the quotient space by the action of G is what the moduli space we're looking at. So what you can say is that this total space here is the total space of a principal G bundle. G is an infinite dimensional group, no matter. It's the total space of a G bundle over the moduli space. And this horizontal space here, this blue one, defines a connection on that bundle. And so what they prove is that if you look at the curvature of that connection downstairs, then that has type 1-1 with respect to the complex structure. And what they also prove is that actually if you have ddc omega equals 0 on M4, then the Hermitian form on the moduli space also satisfies this condition. So that's the one Hermitian structure satisfying ddc omega equals 0. So we do get a metric and we get a complex structure, but that's taking one of these structures. But we're in a slightly different situation. We have an I plus and we have an I minus. So we have a horizontal slice there coming from I plus and another one coming from I minus. So what we want to do is to prove that the metric we get for both of these is the same. So this is a calculation. So we look at a tangent vector on our moduli space, And what we have to do is to represent it in two different ways. So one as, so there's a slice here. So A here is a one form with values in the algebra, satisfies this slice condition with respect to I minus. And we have not the same A, but one which differs by it by something in the Lie algebra of the as a gauge group, which satisfies this equation. So these are two representatives of the same tangent vector on the moduli space. And what we have to do is to prove that actually the inner product is the same for both of these. Once we've done that, we'll know that we have a metric which is compatible with the two complex structures. Well, the proving that is, it's not so difficult, but it's quite long. I don't want to go through it line by line. It's basically integration by parts. So this is how shall I put it? So psi here is a section of the Lie algebra bundle. That inner product I represent this way. So it's like you take traces and so on. Basically, what we have to do is to write down D of something three times and integrate. So this is DC of something, but it's a four form, so it's really D of something. This is a three form, I take D of it, DC plus of it, and that's D of I times this thing here. So if I integrate this, then I get zero by Stokes' theorem, and so then I have to deal with these other terms. So that's the idea. So first of all, you take that relation and integrate. And then you look at the individual terms, and you see that, for example, this term here can be written this way, with this way, so that vanishes because ddc omega equals zero. And also, because of this relation here, we can rewrite this term in terms of like this. So that says that this expression here can be written this way. So we're already using this relation. Then we write down another relation like this, D of this is equal to this, and then you rewrite some of these terms. Then you use this relation, so you go over to the plus, from the plus. This is where you cross over from the plus to the minus, and then you write down another relation like this, integrate, gives you this. It's very unedifying, and then it comes down to this, and then finally you get this. Okay. I mean, I wish there were a more general way of looking at it. In a way there is, but in the generic case, but not a way that I know that works in all the cases. So anyway, so what we get here then is that we have our moduli space of instantons has two complex structures. It has a single metric, which is Hermitian with respect to both of them. And now finally what we have to do is to decide whether it satisfies these equations here. And then we'll be able to say that it has a generalized Kähler structure. So the last part is, so now we have to again look at the infinite dimensional picture. At least it's easier to see what's happening this way. So if you look at the whole affine space of all connections on some vector bundle, then a tangent vector, as I said before, is a one form with values in the Lie algebra. And using your form, so this is going to be omega plus or omega minus, using your Hermitian form, you can define a form on this affine space. Now, omega is itself not closed, but this big omega is closed. So the fact that this is not closed doesn't affect things at this stage. So big omega, this two-form, symplectic form on this infinite dimensional affine space, is closed because essentially it's got constant coefficients. I mean, it doesn't depend on the connection that you're at. Another way of saying it is that it's invariant under translation, and that means that it's actually closed. So we have this two form, so both omega plus and omega minus define us two forms on the space of all connections, and these are closed and gauge invariant. And now, and these are what give us our Hermitian forms downstairs, the ones which we know exist already. But how are they defined? So I'm going to call them omega bar plus or minus. These are going to be Hermitian forms on the moduli space. They're basically the restriction of our closed form omega on the space of all connections to the space of anti-self dual connections, but we have to restrict the horizontal spaces. Right? So that's the way we do it. We look at kind of our blue horizontal slice, and we look at this two form, but we restrict it to the horizontal space, and that defines us our mission form downstairs. So then, as you know, there's a well-known formula, which I can never remember, relating the exterior derivative of a two-form to the Lie bracket. And if omega is closed, this right-hand side is always zero. So this is cyclically moving ABC around. So what we know is that omega is closed, but the only problem is that, I mean, the reason that omega bar is not closed is because when we take two horizontal vector fields, then the Lie bracket is not necessarily horizontal. It would be if that connection was flat, but it's not flat. So because omega is closed, we get a formula for d of omega bar, which just involves this curvature, if you like, of that of the g connection. So that's what it is. This bracket of two horizontal vector fields is essentially how you define the curvature of a connection. So this is, if you like, you can think of psi as being an element of the Lie algebra of the gauge group. Then dA psi is the corresponding vector field, which is the Lie bracket of those two horizontal vector fields. So we get this formula here. And then by integration by parts, we take the d over, and then we have to differentiate the c, if you like, there. But then what is c? Well, c is an infinitesimal variation of a connection, of an anti-self dual connection. So this DAC is really the infinitesimal variation in the direction C of the curvature, but we know that the curvature is anti-self dual, so its wedge product with omega is zero, so this term actually disappears, and what we get is that this is equal to this. So this is where the d omega comes in. But what do we want to do? We don't want to prove that d omega bar is zero, we just want to prove that some relationship between the DC plus of that and the DC minus of the minus one. So what happens now is that so we're trying to look at DC omega, which is like plugging in I, and I here. But what we know is that the curvature of this G bundle is of type 1, 1, which means that the I's go through. So actually what that means is that this our integral here is that the I's go through all of this, and so what we had here was D omega. But when we apply it to I, it becomes DC. Anyway, we get that this DC of the omega bar that we want is the integral of the DC inside against this. So we have this relationship on the four manifold, so we get the same relationship on the moduli space. What we don't get is that this is DB, or minus DB. And why is that? So there's an interesting point here. And it really comes from this equation here. So I have these two Hermitian forms, omega plus and omega minus, and I can use this formula tells me the way in which they descend to forms downstairs. If I replace omega here by b, which was just a two form, any two form is the one that came out of the generalized Kähler structure, then I get stuck at this stage here, that B is not necessarily orthogonal to F prime. I mean, B is not necessarily self-dual. So this is the problem, that if I do this argument with B, then I get something which won't descend downstairs. So there's a little subtlety here, which is that that we get almost the same structure as a generalized Kähler manifold, but we get a three form here, which is not necessarily d of a two form. It's still closed because we know that ddc omega equals zero, if you like, from Telemann, which is essentially following this argument through. So these things, they don't cause too much trouble because, as you may read in Marco's thesis, you can twist all of these structures by a three form. It's that Courant bracket, you can introduce the three form, modify the Courant bracket, And so this is what's called a, it's not quite a generalized Kähler manifold, but it's what's called a twisted generalized Kähler manifold. All it means is that in that definition you replace dB by H, by three form, which is not necessarily exact. So the conclusion is that that the moduli space of instantons on a generalized Kähler four manifold is itself a generalized Kähler manifold, but in this twisted sense. So that was a theorem, well, a calculation almost, in Riemannian geometry. It says that the moduli space of instantons inherits the structure of this generalized Kähler structure. But what it motivates is a more interesting question, because if we now think of this generalized Kähler structure on the instanton moduli space as being not a pair of connections and a free form and so on and so forth, but if we think of it as being a pair of generalized complex structures, after all, that's where we started from. We started with a pair of generalized complex structures which commuted. Then the question that comes is, can we describe these two generalized complex structures on the moduli space in terms of the original generalized complex structures on the four manifold? In other words, can we go directly? Is there some object on, you know, if we have a manifold, a four-dimensional manifold with a generalized complex structure, is there some class of objects whose moduli space is a generalized complex manifold? And if we choose a commuting generalized complex structure which makes it into generalized Kähler, this moduli space becomes the instanton. So this is a little difficult to try and understand what it means. I mean, the only example that we have, of course, is the rather extreme example that if we have a holomorphic vector bundle, so if we think of stable holomorphic bundles, if we think of one of the generalized complex structures as being an ordinary complex structure, then we know that our moduli space of instantons is the moduli space of holomorphic stable bundles. Of course, stability is an issue there, that you need a little bit extra in the complex structure to describe stability. On the other hand, at the other extreme, if we're just talking about an ordinary Kähler manifold, at the other extreme, you would say, what sort of object, you have the symplectic structure, you know, what sort of objects can we define only using a symplectic structure whose moduli space is the moduli space of instantons? That's a very difficult question. I mean, I don't think we're going to talk about connections in that respect. You can talk about connections whose curvature is primitive, but that's clearly not the right idea. There are too few equations there. So this is the question that this structure raises. And I have no general idea other than to say that possibly it's something to do with non-commutative holomorphic bundles or something like that. Anyway, it's a question. I'll leave you with the question, and maybe I've got to finish there.